This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Food and storytelling have gone hand in hand for Sherry Castle since she was a little girl. She wrote her first original recipe when she was just 4 years old. She sent it accompanied by a story and a photograph to a cooking show that she and her grandmother watched every afternoon. In elementary school, she spent hours thumbing through cookbooks in her school's library and dreamed of the faraway lands and the people who ate things like galettes and canapés. As an adult, Sherry turned her passion for food, writing, and storytelling into a career. She wrote more than 750 original recipes, contributed to more than a dozen cookbooks, and is frequently called on by institutions ranging from the Smithsonian to the New York Times to Southern Living to tell the stories of Southern fare. Sherry Castle has authored two of her own cookbooks, the Southern Living Community Cookbook and the new Southern Garden Cookbook, and she joins us in our studio now. Sherry Castle, welcome back.
Thank you, my friend. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. And now get the whole story, because you've been talking about food for us a couple of times. But take us back to the beginning. Born in Watauga County in western North Carolina, where your family has deep roots, right?
Exactly. Both sides of the family have been there since they got off the boat in the 1800s. My father's family, the Castles, were from a small community called Zionville that was right on the North Carolina-Tennessee state line. The house was so close to the line that although the house was in North Carolina, the cows lived in Tennessee. And then my mother's people lived on kind of the opposite end, more toward Deep Gap, for people that know that, way, way, way back up in the mountains on a gorgeous farm that straddled the New River.
Well, great stuff. I didn't even know they had a harbor there in western North Carolina, but at the time, I suppose, just off the boat. You were close with your dad, who's quite a character. Tell us more about your dad.
Oh, my dad is one. He's a wonderful man. He knows everybody in the world. He has friends wherever he goes. I have often said that if NASA ever actually gets humans on Mars, the first thing the Martians are going to ask are, do y'all know Lynn Castle? He's that kind of guy.
He's that guy, huh? So friendly, knew everybody, raised in part by your grandmother as well. Tell us about your relationship with her.
Yes, I was in many ways much more like my grandmother's fourth child than her oldest grandchild. She was only in her mid-40s when I came along, and I spent my days and a fair number of my nights with her, and we were best friends. I mean, you know, she loved all of her grandchildren, but it was pretty well known I was the pick. And it would be impossible to enumerate the number of gifts that she gave me, but probably the best was is that every week we drove into Boone and went to the public library. She was a voracious reader, and turns out I was too, and so we both would check out as many books as we were allowed to take home, and that's how we spent our spare moments that we had, was reading, and I could read anything I wanted, as many books as I could carry, and that's a tremendous gift. It set up a lot of things that have continued to this day.
Well, how long was that ride? Because those conversations back and forth must have been.
There were conversations back and forth. And, you know, it was to downtown Boone from where they were living when I was very small was really less than 10 miles. But it was just the two of us. And she drove a navy blue Nash Rambler station wagon with, you know, push button gear buttons on the dashboard.
Yeah.
And my grandfather had cut a piece of foam rubber to fit in what we called the back, you know, the containment area in the back. And that's where I rode around with my dolls and my books and my thoughts and my mama, which is what I called her. It was a grand thing.
What kind of books were you reading then?
I loved fiction of all kinds. I particularly liked stories of anybody that was a pioneer or an explorer or the first to do such and such. And, you know, it's funny. I spent my book allotment with her on entertainment, you know, fiction and so forth. But when I started school, I knew how to read. And I don't know why I knew how to read so well at an early age, but I did. And back then, they weren't sure what to do with children that knew how, you know, that were so far ahead. And so until about fourth or fifth grade, when the other kids were working on reading, I either got to go to the office to like collect papers, maybe help a student teacher assemble a bulletin board, or my favorite thing was to go to the school library, where a wonderful woman named Mrs. Pease was the school librarian, and I started pulling cookbooks down off the shelf, and I read about things I could not pronounce, but that intrigued. I mean, it was my Arabian Nights stories to talk about things that I just couldn't imagine, but kind of fed into this notion I had that what one ate in this world had a lot to do with your station.
Already you had that idea?
Yes, and I can't explain it. Yeah. I know it was there. A little bit of it came from watching soap operas with my grandmother in the summers and after school, what she called her stories. And on the stories, those people were living a whole lot better than we were, and they were eating dinner every night, whereas we reserve the word dinner to be only after church on Sunday. And I got this notion, man, if I can ever figure out how to get in the world of the daily dinner eaters, I will have done something.
That's the title of your next novel. So how much of it was, I mean, obviously beautiful pictures. I'm assuming many of these cookbooks, glossy pictures, exotic foods, exotic ingredients, and also allows you to imagine a whole other world, the people who are eating this food that you'd never seen. So what part of it was adventure fantasy, and what part was culinary fantasy? Like, what is this stuff? And I'd love to make it. Were you imagining yourself in the kitchen?
Yes, and I think it was, by and large, culinary inquiry. You know, there might have been something else, but just the idea that there were all these things to eat, which meant there were all these ways to be, and that's what I wanted. I always thought, I want to go places, and this food is going to be part of my ticket out.
You are what you eat.
Exactly.
You went to a lab school in Appalachia State at the campus, and this is where this happened, right? You were at
exactly.
the lab school.
Exactly.
Which is why they would do things like send you to a library if you were a little advanced. You wrote your first recipe when you were four?
I did. It was for what I called Hawaiian Tropic Sunset Delight, because I had an affinity for adjectives even back then.
Yes.
And it is what we would now call a smoothie. Yeah. My grandmother had gotten a blender with S&H green stamps people used to accumulate and stamp into books in exchange for merchandise. And she'd gotten a blender, and I remember putting juices and fruits and coconut and things and whirring it up in the blender. And because I could read and write, I jotted down my recipe. I drew a picture of it, wrote a story to go with it, and mailed it to the Betty Feaser Show, which was a 30-minute homekeeping show. She was sort of the Martha Stewart of Charlotte. And we could get Channel 3 in Boone. And I mailed it off to Betty, and I know that she sent me an autographed headshot back. There might have been other things. Unfortunately, it's been lost, which is unusual because I tend to have everything. But I do recall my grandmother's elation that this signed photo was pretty firm evidence I would grow up and marry Betty's son, Bob.
That's what she took away
from
this.
Yeah.
Well, what about your grandmother? I mean, was she a cook? Did she like
to
cook?
She was a fantastic cook. Yeah, she was a cook of renown in our community. You know, when there was a cover dish supper at the church or something like that, everybody wanted some of Madge Castle's, whatever it was. So, yes, I mean, I don't think that she was a talented cook, but I don't think that she gave it a lot of thought. It was just part of what you did to raise a family back then. But she was incredibly curious. And then when I came down off the mountain to start college and discovered that I could buy some of these things I had read about all these years, I started taking them back home with me. And she would eat whatever I brought with curiosity and with affection, you know, adzuki beans and duck and tofu and all of this. And it was a real cornerstone of our sharing that she understood my curiosity.
That's very interesting. And embraced it. I mean, not only understood it with you, but actually liked what you brought home. Because you can imagine somebody who had cooked these ways for this long, got well known for country cooking, ain't going to take to these kind of exotic ingredients.
Right, but she had a remarkably open mind. I mean, for a woman of her era, she was remarkably curious about all sorts of things. And I think it delighted her that I brought these tastes home.
Now, you talked about being able to shop by the time you got to college for exotic ingredients, what would seem to me, seem to you at the time as exotic. But you started experimenting, really, with cooking around the age of 13. Right?
I did. When I was about 13, I requested my own copy of The Joy of Cooking, which, in fact, my grandmother gave me. It was either for my birthday or Christmas that year. And based on what I was reading in that, I had my driver's license by then, and I would drive down off the mount to Charlotte and so forth to larger, better stocked grocery stores to bring back, you know, cheeses and handmade pastas and things like that to start cooking. And that was not long before I took over pretty much the preparation of our holiday meals and so forth.
13?
You
were driving at 13? Was that were you getting ready for NASCAR?
You could drive,
or what were you doing?
You could drive around town. I waited until I turned 16 and was legal to actually, you know, cross state lines and
Got
things
it.
Like that.
So, and these, did you cook with your grandmother? I mean, up through this whole period. Yes, you cook together?
We cook together. Sometimes literally on the same dish. Sometimes we would trade off. She would do one thing, I would do the other. And it was a time that it was usually only the two of us in the house, and another expression of that unbelievable camaraderie and deep devotion. And we adored one another.
What was the rest of your family thinking of those dishes you began whipping up very early, 13,
14? Well, we didn't always say who made them.
I see.
Yeah.
But everybody ate them.
You know, so far as I recall, although I do remember making a few things that only delighted me and Mama, and that's fine too.
Today I'm talking to food writer and culinary instructor Sherry Castle. She has authored the Southern Living Community Cookbook and also the New Southern Garden Cookbook. She has authored about 750 recipes and gets called on all the time by people who need to know about food, particularly regional cooking. And we will continue our conversation with her on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with food writer Sherry Castle, who has contributed to more than a dozen cookbooks, written articles about Southern food, and a wide range of publications. So in that break, we're comparing grandmothers, because I was talking about my Italian grandmother who would cook for us, and I was in awe at the age of 8 and 9 years old at the amount of food she could put out. But the one thing we would do on Saturday morning was she'd make coffee for me, which I wasn't supposed to have. And I found out we have something in common about it. Tell us about your coffee.
Is you had coffee with lots of canned milk, evaporated milk in it, which I put in my coffee to this day because that is the taste of home to me.
And then she would pour it into the saucer.
In the saucer, back and forth and back and forth. She called it saucering the coffee to cool it off. And yes, and she would put mine when I was very small in a little orange juice glass for some reason. And then later, as I got older and we would go visit, she had a sister who lived in Indiana, and we would leave, you know, well before sunup, driving up to Indiana. And when we got kind of on slightly flatter land, she would reach over the back seat and hand me an egg sandwich wrapped in and Cut-Rite wax paper.
Oh, yeah.
And I got my own thermos of coffee, and that was living. Let me tell
wow.
you, I've never had first class service on a flight that can compare to the thrill of that egg sandwich and coffee
across
the
back seat.
Did she have
that little seam in the white bread where the knife went through and kind of sealed it?
Oh, absolutely.
That's poetry right there.
And buttered both sides. No skimping for her.
Well, talk about the rest of your life there in Western North Carolina and what it was like to grow up there. I mean, obviously you have these aspirations. You can't meet all of them by staying in Western North Carolina. What was it like growing up?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time alone. I mean, I've talked about with my grandmother, and I did have friends, but I've always been sort of a loner at heart, spent a lot of time with my thoughts and with my books and so forth. I was always a good student, which was both the best and the worst thing about living there. I knew that it was going to be in my favor to be that way, but sometimes it made it hard to fit in. I was the first of my immediate family to go away to college, and the only input they had in that entire process is my parents, I'm speaking to my parents, is that you cannot leave the state of North Carolina. Going to Chapel Hill, which is really about the only option I had, was going to the dark side of the moon for them. And they were afraid of things they couldn't articulate. But I did, you know, in high school, I knew I was a good student. I felt empowered and emboldened by that, and went to Carolina. And I will never forget that feeling of like, I have achieved escape velocity. I am in.
Almost escape, because you had a scholarship from the factory where your dad was employed,
right.
And that meant that you spent your summers back in Western
Carolina. I had to go back. I mean, you know, the scholarship was very valuable, very necessary, but you're right. It did make me have to return to Boone and work in a factory every summer, and that was quite an education. Talk about reinforcement that this is not the life that I want to live. I mean, you know, the people were good, and I was proud to be there, and I was horrified to be there, both. It certainly set me up to go back into a robust academic year.
So you can certainly understand all of that about having these aspirations, about being away and thinking about the possibilities for yourself to fully mature and grow into who you are, and also this deep love for your family. How were you feeling conflicted about this leaving?
I think anyone that leaves is conflicted. I mean, you know, I didn't want to be disrespectful for them, but at the same time, there was very little about their way of life I wanted to embrace and feel that way even now. I think that they were always, I mean, I, you know, parts of my family loved me deeply, but I think they were perplexed, and I perplexed by them, and that persists even now. Familial love can be a prickly intersection of thoughts and ways of life.
So you're saying they haven't completely understood or embraced your wanting to leave?
No, I think that they're baffled by it. I mean, I say sometimes in jest and sometimes in complete seriousness, I've been gone for 36 years and my dad thinks it's a phase I'll outgrow.
You studied English and broadcasting and then ended up moving back to Western North Carolina to do some legal writing.
For a very short period of time, I was when I got out of college, jobs were very hard to come by. It happened to be a pretty major recession at the time. And I moved back home because I could not afford the rent on my apartment in Carver any longer and was trying to find a job. And one day, a cousin who worked at a local downtown Boone law firm said, "Our receptionist is out on maternity leave. Would you like to come answer the phones for 6 weeks?" It was $4 an hour, which was $4 an hour more than I was making doing nothing. So I went and did that and captured the attention of the attorneys. They said, if you'll go to law school, we'll pay for it, but you have to come back to Boone. And it wasn't a bargain I could strike. Yeah. I wasn't going to do that. But shortly, I only did that for a very few months. And then I decided that, well, if this legal research thing can keep me employed while I figure out what the next move is, let me see if I can do it in a larger town. I got a job offer from Charlotte and one from Raleigh. And I really don't know why I chose Raleigh, but wound up working for a major law firm in downtown Raleigh doing legal research because I could read, I could write, and I could form good sentences.
John Edwards Law Firm.
Yes, it was in fact the firm where John Edwards was making his name in civil litigation, and he was one of the attorneys for whom I did research and writing.
Who did you when you went to school? As we said, you studied broadcasting and English, right?
Mm-hmm.
What
right.
were you planning to do with that? What were you?
My goal was to get a PhD in English and be a professor who wrote short stories and novels on the side. And, you know, there's a little part of me that still kind of holds out hope for that, although the odds aren't in my favor. But that was what I wanted to do, is I wanted to be a writer. But the English major did not sit well with my dad, who was footing the bill. I mean, he was a man that wanted me to have a job, although I suspect his vision of my job would be, you know, some sort of an office thing or a bank teller or something. And so I sort of, to placate him, I switched to broadcasting, but still wound up with more hours in English than I did in my major because I wanted to be a writer. Words have always been my stock in trade.
So there you are. And then you end up in Raleigh working for a law firm, as it turns out, a John Edwards law firm. Mm-hmm. And so where do you go from there? What happens
next? Where I literally went from that was down the road a few miles and started working for Capital Broadcasting. I was a corporate communications person for them, which was an umbrella term that covered a lot of different things. I did event planning. I wrote papers. I wrote things. But again, it was applying words to situations. I did that for about 3 years and then went to what was the most corporate job I ever had. I was a technical writer and then later on a marketing writer for IBM. I wrote about computers and I wrote about software and all sorts of things. And I did that for 7 years. And I will say that all of these things in hindsight were good training, because if you can write well about things you do not understand and have no care for whatsoever, you can really write about the things that matter.
Well, I take your point there, but I'm wondering if technical writing for software manuals made you pining for the mountains.
No, that pining was just there. I mean, I can definitely say I was a fish out of water in that environment. It was never comfortable, but...
Well, you got married later and had a daughter. Tell us about her.
My daughter Lily is a senior at Sewanee, the University of the South. She is the joy of my existence. I'll never do anything as useful for mankind as bringing her here. She is intelligent and kind and articulate, and I now know how my mama felt about me, because it's how I feel about my daughter. I get it now.
Where was food in all of this for you? Again, your college years, now writing, working for law firms, technical writing. Had food taken a backseat?
A backseat as a professional pursuit, because that never occurred to me, but I never stopped cooking. I mean, even when I was in high school, I was doing banquets for like the senior class banquet and things like that. And I was making crepes and Mornay sauce and so forth. And then when I got to college, I at least once a month made what my friends called real food and had folks over for Sunday dinner. And then even in all of these various writing things, I was the person in the office who was a good cook. So when it was time for the office party or whatever, it's like, what did Sherry bring? What did Sherry bring? It didn't occur to me to do food in any serious way until I realized I was going to leave the corporate world when my daughter was an infant. And that was back in the days in the late 90s when corporations would pay you to leave. And so I let IBM pay me. And among the part of the package was re-education money. And I started taking professional cooking courses to corroborate what I knew and to really sort of test the waters on what I knew. And at the end of that, I had decided I wanted to be a cooking teacher, not a restaurateur, but a cooking teacher. Rolled myself, my baby and her stroller and myself into Williams-Sonoma, which had just opened at Crabtree Mall, and said to the young woman at the cash register, would you ever like cooking classes? And she said, how about Saturday? Not who are you? Can you cook? She said, how about Saturday? Uh-huh. And that launched me into a different direction for sure.
What did you do that Saturday?
You know, I don't recall. That is an excellent question, but I don't recall. But knowing me and knowing sort of what my proclivities have always been, it was either something authentically Southern or authentically Italian.
Well, let me ask you about those threads and go back to the authentically Southern, if I may, because you talked about being in college and people admiring and looking forward to your real food. Mm-hmm. Was that mountain food?
No, it was not mountain food. I would cook mountain food for myself, but I had pretty much eschewed that as is something that was not going to further my cause in getting out into the world. It really wasn't until around 2001 that I had the big epiphany, the big bang of appreciation of Southern cooking and mountain cooking. And now that really changed the trajectory of the rest of my career and in ways I have not seen the end of.
Well, so talk about that epiphany and your realization.
Well, I had I got to go to Italy with a group of fellow chefs and food writers in the early 2000s, and my first trip was to Umbria, which remains my favorite part of Italy, and we were having a meal one night, and as I looked at the meal, and as I looked out the windows at the landscape there, it was a doppelganger of the terrain and the meals that I had in my Appalachian upbringing. And the epiphany is that if I've traveled halfway around the world to give respect and credence and scholarly endeavor to the food of Italy, perhaps the food of my own people warrant this same respect and this same curiosity. And I've combined the two ever since.
And there is a distinction that you make between certainly mountain food that we would have in the mountains that may also, those mountains may be in the American South, and what we might think of as Southern cuisine.
Exactly, because the mountains, if you look at a map, clearly the mountain South is in the South, but it's not from around there. It has, because of the terrain and the elevation and the weather patterns, it is like living in New England, and the things we grew in our growing season and our food preservation and so forth was far more like New England than the rest of the South. And that the analogy I usually draw is it's sort of like bourbon and whiskey. Bourbon's a type of whiskey, but it's distinguished from the rest. Mountain food is part of Southern cooking, but it is very dissimilar in most ways.
When you saw the similarities between Italian food, that mountain food that you saw there, and the things you ate at home, what were they? Obviously, I wouldn't think that the menu was the same. Or
it really is. Well, Italy is a wide-ranging landscape of cuisines and so forth, but there were beans and greens and hearth bread that resembles a biscuit, and we had stewed apples and freshly made pork sausage. I remember that when we would go to the market in this community, when I looked out on the roadside, there were tobacco fields and apple orchards and things that people just don't normally think about Italy. And maybe that's why I felt so at home there, is I'm like, gosh, I know how to do this.
You also began to realize you were a good recipe writer.
Yes.
What does that mean? What does it mean to be a recipe writer?
A recipe writer is, well, there's two parts. So there's the actual technical part. part, the list of ingredients and the step-by-step instructions. And those are the nouns in a recipe. Right. The words that surround it, the head notes and the sidebars and so forth, those are the adjectives and verbs. That's what keeps a well-written recipe from just being a lab report. But, you know, at its essence, the intention of a recipe is to try to convey to the cook in terms that are appropriate for their interests and abilities how to conduct a procedure.
Do you create the dish yourself? When we talk about recipe writing, how much of that is sort of telling a story around a recipe that you've inherited, and how much of it is creating the dish?
Well, it can be both. I mean, I'm hired to do both, and I do both for my own purposes. Sometimes somebody will say, I need 11 recipes that use chicken breasts. Well, obviously, I'm thinking about chicken breasts then. Sometimes somebody will say, I need 11 recipes that make me feel as though I am in Paris, and that's going to be a different thing. Ultimately, I want all of my recipes to work, but I have to turn my cap around to different directions depending on what the assignment is.
You started ghostwriting cookbooks, and therein lies quite a story.
It always intrigues people a lot.
You're going to do Cookbook Confidential right now.
I could. I can tell you everything except for whom I've written, because there used to be a movie called Fight Club, and sort of the tagline was, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. Well, the first rule of being a ghostwriter is you do not reveal the clients. But I can tell you circumstances surrounding it, you know, different experiences I've had. I've done several of these books now, usually do at least one a year.
Well, and is it true that these are recipes that maybe the client, the celebrity, they're not theirs?
No, I can assure you they're not theirs. One book pops into mind where I never met the person until right before the person went on a national media tour, right before this person went on a very famous Daily Show, I had to meet with them so that they could recognize the food in their own book on site before the media tour began.
Because you don't want to hand them a carrot casserole, they think it's squash or something.
Right. Or a carrot, not know that's what a carrot is. I mean, it's that bad sometimes.
even worse. Are you finding, you're just putting recipes together? Does the publisher say, throw these recipes together?
There's a wide range of things. Sometimes it is up to me to conceive of the entire book. What's going to be in it? What's it going to be about? The recipes, the voice and everything. Sometimes it's only the recipes. Sometimes I'm hired to write only the text. But I have had it, where there was no instruction at all other than you need to write a book for so-and-so and it's due on this date. And then I've had where there was a little bit of direction or something like that, maybe some scribble notes. I did one for a restaurant one time where an administrative assistant had photocopied the restaurant menu and taken a pink highlighter and highlighted some of the dishes and said, tell us how somebody would make this at home.
We've always suspected this, that the restaurant really isn't going to tell us how they make it. But you're saying you had to actually sort of retrofit the title.
Oh, absolutely. I also did a book one time where all the photography had been done before the book had been started, so to speak. And I had to write recipes by examining the photographs and trying to figure out what the bits and pieces were.
I think that's a carrot. So, and I'm getting back to the recipe for the this restaurant. I mean, did you get to taste it to see,
No.
Just looking at the name of the thing,
yeah,
it's like...
Exactly. I'm not saying this is optimal, and I'm certainly not saying that all of my jobs have been that dire. But I will say that, you know, if they were going to have somebody do something like ludicrous, they were pretty lucky it was me, because I can look at... food and certain recipes and certainly descriptions, and it's like people who can read music and hear the tune in their mind. I can read something and taste it pretty well in my mind.
Your daughter also grew up with an impressive palate, I'm told.
She did. I would actually kill for her palate. Her sense of nuance is amazing. And of course, because she was with me, you know, she was exposed to maybe more types of food than most kids. I remember very fondly that when she was 4 years old, the little preschool she went to got in a new supply of pretend food, you know, the plastic fake food that comes with the little kitchens and stuff. And when I went to pick her up that day, the teacher said, well, it's really a good thing Lily was here, because all this came from Europe and she could tell us what the kohlrabi and the leeks and the radicchio were.
And how to use them. Do you cook together? Did you?
We We didn't so much grow. I mean, we did, but we didn't. I mean, remember, we also had the mother-daughter dynamic growing up, not just cooking and receiving. But we cook together now, and I'm very gratified that she is curious about cooking. I have no anticipation she'll ever do it professionally, but she can do it for joy and for camaraderie and because she likes to cook for her friends. And if I could convey anything, that would have been the thing I would have chosen, is cook for joy and cook from love.
We will find out just how to do that when my conversation continues with Sherry Castle. She's an award-winning professional food writer who has contributed to a number of magazines, news outlets, and cookbooks. Our conversation continues just ahead on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Sherry Castle is my guest this hour. She's a food writer and culinary instructor, and she's the author of the new Southern Living Community Cookbook, as well as the new Southern Garden Cookbook. Tell us how you ended up writing your first solo cookbook, because I understood you took a fairly atypical approach to that.
I did take an atypical approach. I had written, you know, several books and collaborated and contributed, but because so much of my work was covert, it was more challenging than I had anticipated to get my first solo title. I wound up working with UNC Press, and I was very clear on what I wanted the book to be. And I wanted to write about fresh produce, farmers markets, CSA boxes, which no one had heard of at the time, and so forth. And I knew that I wanted the book to be organized, not, as most cookbooks are, appetizers through desserts, but by the main ingredient, apples through zucchini. And the reason I was so adamant about that organization is that's how fresh food comes into many people's lives. If you have a backyard garden, you go to the farmer's market, you're not out there to pick a quarter cup of beans. You're out to pick all the beans that are ready to be picked that day. And even if you go to a farmer's market, you come home and you've got these little bags and these little boxes of this, that, and the other. And then you're like, well, now what am I going to do? Well, I thought, well, what you do is if you have a bag of peaches, you go to the peaches chapter. And I had to fight really hard for that organization. But I'm incredibly gratified by the response of the readers. People, even in other cities that I've been to sometimes, will come up and say, are you Sherry Castle? I have your book and I use it. It never leaves my kitchen counter. I mean, there could be no greater outcome for a cookbook writer than that.
And there has been an explosion, certainly an increase in the number of people who see the value in foods that are grown sustainably and more conscientiously, farmers markets and other markets. What do you think accounts for that? I mean, sometimes you do spend a couple of extra dollars on that food. Why? What's going on?
Well, there? I think that it's part of the, you know, sort of the locavore and locavism thing. I think that there's some sentimentality behind it, that people were trying to figure out why food didn't taste the way it used to, and it's because it wasn't what it used to be. I think that people can come at it for financial or environmental reasons, or even sometimes just as a statement of principle on what they hold dear and how they wish to spend their dollars to manifest what they consider a priority. That was certainly what it was for me.
Your book had a new definition of what constitutes Southern food, right?
Both a very old and very new definition. I think that as a person who writes a lot about Southern food, we've come a long way in the last 10 years, but there's still one of the greatest challenges is that so many people think that they understand it already. And the first thing you have to do is disabuse them of the misconceptions and then try to write a clearer picture.
What are some of the misconceptions?
That everything's fried. And that it's all about the barbecue and fried chicken. I wrote a story one time where I said, yes, that barbecue and fried chicken might be the homecoming queen, but that the agrarian South built the float.
And a lot of influences, as you say. I mean, in the mountains, you've got the influence of New England, which is to say the British Isles. We have African influences here in the South and others. And so all of them sort of bring what they brought to this continent, and then it starts to merge.
There is no region in the country that has more diversity and more more creativity, I think, than Southern food, because the South has always been comprised of people that, except for the Native Americans, of people that came from somewhere else, either by force or by choice. And each of them brought something that they knew, and they combined what they brought with what they found. And I think that's still the definition of Southern food now, is it's constantly evolving. But the common denominator is that unmistakable sense of place. I think that good Southern food is a culinary GPS. One bite, you know where you are. I
know you are. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing, because I know you wrote a piece for Southern Living in 2014 about casseroles.
I did. I have written for Southern Living for more than a decade and still writing a lot now. And it was mainly recipe work, but this was sort of the brink of me writing more text for them and so forth. And the senior editor said, we are doing something on casseroles, and I would like for you to write an essay on how casseroles make a person feel. And that was only the direction, direction that he provided. And I sat down and without drawing a breath and without a single typo, banged out an essay that's like, wow, I guess that's been in there all along, just waiting to be released.
Just needed to be reheated.
Exactly.
Would you read an excerpt first?
I would love to read a bit. The day of my adored grandmother's funeral was filled with equal parts immeasurable love and unspeakable loss. The family returned to her house to find the kitchen brimming with homemade food brought by the scores of friends and neighbors that a well-lived life in a small southern town can garner. I lifted lids until I found my favorite casserole, the type my grandmother often made for me. It was chunky with tender chicken, creamy from a can of soup, and crowned with buttered stuffing mix. I didn't need to look to know that the kind, generous cook's name was written on a strip of masking tape on the bottom of the dish. I spooned some up and found a quiet spot in the house where I could sit cross-legged on the floor with my toddler daughter in my lap. One bowl and one spoon for the two of us. It was the only moment all day that made any sense. Overwhelmed people deserve home cooking. Homemade conveys heartfelt. When words don't come easy, a handmade casserole says plenty. It says, I understand your normal life has come to a complete stop for a few days, so I'm going to pause mine long enough to make you something good to eat. A reliable casserole can deliver comfort and joy, but it's not the food so much as the gesture of genuine compassion. Casserole unto others, as you would have them casserole unto you.
There you go. I'm talking with Southern food writer and instructor Sherry Castle, reading an excerpt from an essay about casseroles. Casseroles and funerals, you know, it and food. I don't know when it was that struck me once when I was camped out when my good friend's father died, and I had to go up there. So I was there for the 3 days in that place, watching the food come and go for 3 days and sort of plates being taken up and casseroles kind of diminishing as you go, and then something else replaces it. There was a kind of hope in all of that too. Like there's a process that's going on, and as you point out, people have stopped their lives. They were not planning to bring that ham and beans or make those casseroles.
Right.
Stopped their lives, made it all, brought it over, and it becomes part of a process, another whole process.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember thinking on the day of both the funerals of both my grandparents is that there were few things that made sense, but I could count on who was going to bring the deviled eggs and who was going to bring this, that, and the other. It was one of the first signs that life was going to go on. It was something I could expect.
A little bit of that is changing these days, isn't it?
It is. I hear more and more people, going to restaurants or having funerals catered. And I got to tell you, that breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. It breaks my heart. I hope that we do not lose the idea of taking food to the bereaved. It matters. It's a sign of our civility.
Yeah. I mean, you've stopped what you're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, but there's also, it's certainly not amusing at the time that you're the person that's in it. But when I was growing up in Boone, we had two sisters. They were identical twins. And, we often think of identical twins as small children. You forget that they will remain identical until they're up in their 80s. And these ladies were, and they had never married, and they dressed in identical clothing every day of their life. And for reasons that I can't explain, they were always the very first to show up at someone's house with a plate of ham biscuits when someone had passed away. And we didn't know if they were getting tipped off by somebody in the hospital, if they had a police scanner, but they were always first in line. And I can remember thinking, oh, my God, one of these days they're going to show up before word gets around. Somebody's going to open the door and say, oh, God, it's the Danner sisters. Count noses. Who's not here?
Terrifying to see them. Grim Reaper. Writing about Southern food, I guess, gets you in trouble now and then. You wrote a piece for The Bitter Southerner and got quite a response.
I did. It came out a year ago, right along now. It was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving a year ago. And what I was asked to write by one of the founders of the magazine was, he said, give me five recipes that describes the culinary DNA of Southern cuisine. Well, I knew it was a ridiculous request and an impossible task, but I said yes anyhow, just to see how it was going to turn out. And I worked on it for a while. It's a very long piece, and I went to 7. Not that 7 is any more reasonable term right. than would be 700 or 7,000. But what I did was I chose some recipes and dishes, not for what they were, but for what they represented. You know, there had to be something with corn. There needed to be something with this, that, and the other. And I wrote at the end of the introduction, you know, that my list was not intended to be the definitive word. It was intended to inspire people who care about food and about the role that food plays in their family and their lives to make their own list. Well, it seems that people kind of missed that part. And they opened up the page and they saw the photographs and they drew swords. And if anybody thinks food doesn't matter, make somebody mad over food. You will find out. I got death threats. I really did. We actually had to take some of the comments down. And we had to make sure that my home address was not very visible because it got pretty rowdy there
for a while.
This for
what you left out, I'm assuming.
Yes. It seems that, I mean, each of us does have a completely individual experience with the food of our youth or the food of our past or the food of the South in this case. But it seemed that if I didn't write down verbatim what their granny made, it was like I had backhanded the poor woman in the mouth. People were livid.
And I think it kind of explains, I mean, I think the corollary to that is how we will revert to foods, even if our palate has perhaps become more sophisticated. Maybe we're a little more concerned about the ingredients, where they came from. Putting a can of cream of mushroom soup over some canned beans at Thanksgiving is just what you got to do.
It's just what you've got to do. I think that that hits the truth on a couple of different points. One is that food memories are the most powerful memories we have, except maybe music. I mean, each of us can have one whiff of something and it's time travel to go back to a different place and a different time. And that becomes even more important around Thanksgiving. I think that the role of Thanksgiving, the table, the food, is to make sure that everyone around that table is comforted and reassured by at least one thing. And if that means that you put some cockamamie thing from that side of the family on the table, do it. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's a meal.
And it'll probably taste pretty darn good.
Yeah,
it will. Your second cookbook was a tribute to community cookbooks around the country.
Exactly. It is a project that I did for Southern Living even back before I was on staff there. And, you know, community cookbooks are those spiral-bound volumes that, you know, people, you know, community people will bring together, usually women in a community, to raise funds for the volunteer fire department or the PTA or something. And I realize that I have great affinity for those books because they are accidental archives. They are documenting the daily works of people that were given no other, you know, attention in their lives. Often these women, and they were almost always women, it was the only time they ever saw their name in print. And so I have deep affection for those books and am proud of that one because it's a little bit of a tribute.
You say mostly women, but there's a guy named Eddie McGee who features heavily career.
This, people said, you know, how on earth did you narrow down the recipes? Because to prepare for this book, I am the only person, so far as we know, that not only once but twice has read every single recipe that Southern Living ever published, which is around 45,000. It started in February of 1966. And, you know, I needed to narrow down to around 200. That's a lot of vetting. And there were certain recipes that I knew I wanted to be represented categorically. I knew there had to be a pound cake because pound cakes are the workaday baked goods of busy cooks. And because I'm the author, I decided I wanted a cream cheese pound cake. Well, come to find out, there were 13 identical versions of cream cheese pound cakes submitted by readers in those 50 years. But I came across one from a man named Eddie McGee who carried the mail for many years in Elkin, North Carolina. Well, if you live in the same place long enough, you realize that the mail carrier, the mailman in this case, is everyone's neighbor. Everybody knows him. And a lot of people will make baked goods for their mail carrier at Christmas, but Eddie made a homemade cream cheese pound cake for everybody on his route. Well, by golly, there's your sweepstakes winner. You got a great recipe with a great story and a great person. And it doesn't get any better than that.
Now, was it a great pound cake?
Oh, you better believe it. It's magnificent. Mm-hmm.
You often give public talks and are featured in food documentaries, and to this day you still get grief about your accent.
I do, which shocks me because, you know, I know I have an accent, but it's a point of pride for me. Yeah. But just in the past 2 weeks, it's funny that you should ask that. Someone with whom I had corresponded, but we never spoke on the phone, I was interviewed by a publication, and the woman said, "Wow, I never knew you were Southern. You cook so well." Well, I mean, there's no way to respond to that. There is no response to that. And then another thing was, is I had a friend, I mean, a person that is a friend who is a journalist. And we had gathered at someone's house, and I had brought something maybe a little bit unusual to share with my friends. And they said, "What is this?" And I was explaining it to them, you know, and she said, "Wow, every time something smart comes out of your mouth, I'm shocked."
That is a hard one to answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I kind of came up with an answer on that one. You want to know what it was?
What did you say?
I said, "And every time people don't understand the differences between dialect and intellect, I'm shocked."
Hmm. Well, how about these days you're having to navigate that, obviously, but also the change. I mean, has the internet killed the cookbook, and how has it changed your career much?
It has changed my career, but I don't think it has killed the cookbook because you can get recipes off of the internet, but there's no vetting. There's no discernment. There's no corroboration, validation, or anything. I think that if you can become a trusted source for your readers, they're going to come to you because they know what they're going to get. They can rely on it, and you develop relationships with your readers. And, you know, you don't go out to lunch with strangers you find on the internet. You go with your friends. Well, I think that many of my readers consider me a good friend, and they're going to return to me again, and that sort of dynamic and relationship is the saving grace of good cookbooks.
But you said that there is a kind of generational divide that you're detecting these days when it comes to cooking, or at least with regard to your career.
A little bit with my career, you know, because I'm a writer and not a restaurateur, I have not been affected by sexism as much as other components of the culinary world. I'm getting a little bit of ageism, though, because a lot of these editors are incredibly young women, usually women, and I look like their mom, and they can't imagine they would ever want to work with their mom, so why would they want to work with me? So it's, you know, I'm just getting kind of the early rumblings of thunder on that. It'll be interesting to see how it works out.
All right, well, we'll stay tuned and have you back for an update. Sherry Castle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sherry Castle's a food writer, a culinary instructor. She's authored the new Southern Living Community Cookbook, as well as the new Southern Garden Cookbook, and we've got links to that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.